Chapter 14. Can of mid few precedents indeed for such a situation. Clear as daylight, apostrophe he added. Do you understand what that means? From conviction. Apostrophe, and still she did not stir. She did not know what to do. But the luckless wretch was about to give her the opportunity for a beautiful and correct gesture. I have felt in me the power to make you share this conviction, apostrophe he protested, ardently. He had forgotten himself. He made a step towards her, perhaps he stumbled. To me he seemed to be stooping low, as if to touch the hem of her garment. And then the appropriate gesture came. She snatched her skirt away from his polluting contact, and averted her head with an upward tilt. It was magnificently done, this gesture of conventionally unstained honor, of an unblemished, high-minded amateur. Nothing could have been better. And he seemed to think so too, for once more he turned away. But this time he faced no one. He was again panting frightfully, while he fumbled hurriedly in his waistcoat pocket, and then raised his hand to his lips. There was something furtive in this movement, but directly afterwards his bearing changed. His labored breathing gave him a resemblance to a man who had just run a desperate race, but a curious air of detachment, of sudden and profound indifference, replaced the strain of the striving effort. The race was over. I did not want to see what would happen next. I was only too well aware. I tucked the young lady's arm under mine without a word, and made my way with her to the stairs. Her brother walked behind us. Halfway up the short flight she seemed unable to lift her feet high enough for the steps, and we had to pull and push to get her to the top. In the passage she dragged herself along, hanging on my arm, helplessly bent like an old woman. We issued into an empty street through a half-open door, staggering like besotted revelers. At the corner we stopped a four-wheeler, and the ancient driver looked round from his box with morose scorn at our efforts to get her in. Twice during the drive I felt her collapse on my shoulder in a half-faint. Facing us, the youth in knickerbockers remained as mute as a fish, and, till he jumped out with the latch key, sat more still than I would have believed it possible. At the door of their drawing room she left my arm and walked in first, catching at the chairs and tables. She unpinned her hat then, exhausted with the effort, her cloak still hanging from her shoulders, flung herself into a deep armchair, sideways, her face half buried in a cushion. The good brother appeared silently before her with a glass of water. She motioned it away. He drank it himself and walked off to a distant corner behind the grand piano, somewhere. All was still in this room where I had seen, for the first time, Severin, the anti-anarchist, captivated and spellbound by the consummate and hereditary grimaces that in a certain sphere of life take the place of feelings with an excellent effect. I suppose her thoughts were busy with the same memory. Her shoulders shook violently. A pure attack of nerves. When it quieted down she affected firmness. What is done to a man of that sort? What will they do to him? Apostrophe, nothing. They can do nothing to him, apostrophe I assured her, with perfect truth. I was pretty certain he had died in less than 20 minutes from the moment his hand had gone to his lips. For if his fanatical anti-anarchism went even as far as carrying poison in his pocket, only to rob his adversaries of legitimate vengeance, I knew he would take care to provide something that would not fail him when required. She drew an angry breath. There were red spots on her cheeks, and a feverish brilliance in her eyes. Has ever anyone been exposed to such a terrible experience? To think that he had held my hand. That man. Apostrophe, apostrophe, her face twitched, she gulped down a pathetic sob. If I ever felt sure of anything, it was of Severin's high-minded motives. Apostrophe, apostrophe, then she began to weep quietly, which was good for her. Then through her flood of tears, half resentful, what was it he said to me? Wrong conviction. It seemed a vile mockery. What could he mean by it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, that, my dear young lady, apostrophe I said, gently, is more than I or anybody else can ever explain to you. Apostrophe, Mr. Ten flicked a crumb off the front of his coat. And that was strictly true as to her. Dohorn, for instance, understood very well, and so did I, especially after we had been to Severn's lodging in a dismal back street of an intensely respectable quarter. Horn was known there as a friend, and we had no difficulty in being admitted, the slatternly maid merely remarking, as she let us in, that Mr. Severn had not been home that night. Apostrophe, apostrophe, we forced open a couple of drawers in the way of duty, and found a little useful information. The most interesting part was his diary, for this man, engaged in such deadly work, had the weakness to keep a record of the most damnatory kind. There were his acts, and also his thoughts laid bare to us. But the dead don't mind that. They don't mind anything. From conviction. Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes. A vague but ardent humanitarianism had urged him in his first youth into the bitterest extremity of negation and revolt. Afterwards his optimism flinched. He doubted and became lost. You have heard of converted atheists. These turn often into dangerous fanatics, but the soul remains the same. After he had got acquainted with the girl, there are to be met in that diary of his very queer politico-amorous rhapsodies. He took her sovereign grimaces with deadly seriousness. He longed to convert her. But all this cannot interest you. For the rest, I don't know, if you remember it is a good many years ago now the journalistic sensation of the Hermione Street mystery, the finding of a man's body in the cellar of an empty house, the inquest, some arrests, many surmises then silenced the usual end for many obscure martyrs and confessors. The fact is, he was not enough of an optimist. You must be a savage, tyrannical, pitiless, thick and thin optimist, like Horn, for instance, to make a good social rebel of the extreme type. He rose from the table. A waiter hurried up with his overcoat. Another held his hat in readiness. But what became of the young lady? I asked. Do you really want to know? He said, buttoning himself in his fur coat carefully. I confess to the small malice of sending her Severn's diary. She went into retirement, then she went to Florence, then she went into retreat in a convent. I can't tell where she will go next. What does it matter? Gestures. Gestures. Mere gestures of her class. He fitted on his glossy high hat with extreme precision, and casting a rapid glance round the room, full of well-dressed people, innocently dining, muttered between his teeth. And nothing else. That is why their kind is fated to perish. I never met Mr. Ten. Again after that evening, I took to dining at my club. On my next visit to Paris I found my friend all impatience to hear of the effect produced on me by this rare item of his collection. I told him all the story, and he beamed on me with the pride of his distinguished specimen. Isn't Ten well worth knowing? He bubbled over in great delight. He's unique, amazing, absolutely terrific. His enthusiasm grated upon my finer feelings. I told him curtly that the man's cynicism was simply abominable. Oh, abominable, abominable, assented my friend, effusively. And then, you know, he likes to have his little joke sometimes, he added in a confidential tone. I fail to understand the connection of this last remark. I have been utterly unable to discover where in all this the joke comes in. An indignant tail, the brute, dodging in from the rain-swept street, I exchanged a smile and a glance with Miss Blank in the bar of the Three Crows. This exchange was effected with extreme propriety. It is a shock to think that, if still alive, Miss Blank must be something over 60 now. How time passes! Noticing my gaze directed inquiringly at the part I tie in of glass and varnished wood, Miss Blank was good enough to say, encouragingly. Only Mr. German and Mr. Stoner in the parlor with another gentleman I've never seen before. I moved towards the parlor door. A voice discoursing on the other side, it was but a matchboard partition, rose so loudly that the concluding words became quite plain in all their atrocity. That fellow Wilmot fairly dashed her brains out, and a good job too. This inhuman sentiment, since there was nothing profane or improper in it, failed to do as much as to check the slight yawn Miss Blank was achieving behind her hand. And she remained gazing fixedly at the window panes, which streamed with rain. As I opened the parlor door, the same voice went on in the same cruel strain. I was glad when I heard she got the knock from somebody at last. Sorry enough for poor Wilmot, though. That man and I used to be chums at one time. Of course, that was the end of him. A clear case, if there ever was one. No way out of it. None at all. The voice belonged to the gentleman Miss Blank had never seen before. He straddled his long legs on the hearthrug. German, leaning forward, held his pocket handkerchief spread out before the grate. He looked back dismally over his shoulder, and as I slipped behind one of the little wooden tables, I nodded to him. On the other side of the fire, imposingly calm and large, sat Mr. Stoner, jammed tight into a capacious Windsor armchair. There was nothing small about him but his short, white side whiskers. Yards and yards of extra superfine blue cloth made up into an overcoat reposed on a chair by his side. And he must just have brought some liner from sea, because another chair was smothered under his black waterproof, ample as a pall, and made of threefold oiled silk, double-stitched throughout. A man's handbag of the usual size looked like a child's toy on the floor near his feet. I did not nod to him. He was too big to be nodded to in that parlor. He was a senior Trinity pilot, and condescended to take his turn in the cutter only during the summer months. He had been many times in charge of Royal Yachts in and out of Port Victoria. Besides, it's no use nodding to a monument. And he was like one. He didn't speak, he didn't budge. He just sat there, holding his handsome old head up, immovable, and almost bigger than life. It was extremely fine. Mr. Stoner's presence reduced poor old German to a mere shabby wisp of a man, and made the talkative stranger in tweeds on the hearthrug look absurdly boyish. The latter must have been a few years over 30, and was certainly not the sort of individual that gets abashed at the sound of his own voice, because gathering me in, as it were, by a friendly glance, he kept it going without a check. I was glad of it, he repeated, emphatically. Why, you may be surprised at it, but then you haven't gone through the experience I've had of her. I can tell you, it was something to remember. Of course, I got off scot-free myself, as you can see. She did her best to break up my pluck for me, though. She jolly near drove as fine a fellow as ever lived into a madhouse. What do you say to that, eh? Not an eyelid twitched in Mr. Stoner's enormous face. Monumental. The speaker looked straight into my eyes. It used to make me sick to think of her going about the world murdering people. German approached the handkerchief a little nearer to the grate and groaned. It was simply a habit he had. I've seen her once, he declared, with mournful indifference. SS he had a house, the stranger in tweeds turned to stare down at him, surprised. S he had three houses, he corrected, authoritatively. But German was not to be contradicted. S he had a house, I say, he repeated, with dismal obstinacy. A great, big, ugly, white thing. You could see it from miles away sticking up. So you could, assented the other readily. It was old Colchester's notion, though he was always threatening to give her up. He couldn't stand her racket anymore, he declared. It was too much of a good thing for him. He would wash his hands of her if he never got hold of another and so on. I dare say he would have. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.